I had a radio show at one time, rock and roll, many years ago. Actually, at Hobart College. I taught at Hobart College. I had like a student radio thing. So I used to do it with a student once a week, you know. It was really fun. We went out all over Ithaca and places like that.
So you went to Hobart?
I taught at Hobart.
You taught at Hobart?
Yeah.
You didn't go to Calvert?
No, Calvert's a fictional college.
Although it's very reminiscent of Towson State Teachers
College. Oh, it is indeed.
A college I know fairly well.
Oh, do you?
That was the college that Truman Capote made one of his last appearances.
That's
there.
Right.
He was very, very drunk.
Bombed out of his mind, had to be taken off the stage. Yeah, that's their claim to fame.
Well, not really. It was a teacher's college initially, and I think it's called Towson University.
Yeah, it is. Towson. It was Towson State.
Towson State College, maybe.
Towson State College. Or actually, I think it might be a university now. I should know. They actually did give me a honorary Ph.D. there a couple of years ago. And they've been very nice to me. It was a good place for me.
And you went to Towson?
Yeah, I went to Towson. I didn't really intend to go to college at all, actually, but I went because my mother said to me, "You know, hon, you ought to go to college someday." It's the Baltimore accent. And we were living right across the street from it. I mean, within 5 feet of it. And she said, "Why don't you just go over there to school?" So I thought, okay. I didn't really want to go to college. I had big plans. I was going to hitchhike around the world and marry a sultan's daughter or something. But I ended up going to college and...
It was on York Road.
Yeah, paid off. We lived right on Burke Avenue, which was right next door. Which our house is no longer there. It's now a highway. But it was turned out to be a very good place for me.
I used to work on York Road. I worked at Channel 2.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Television Park, they called it.
Television Park.
It was a CBS affiliate when I was there.
Now, where, that was...
Same year as your novel, 1965.
You're kidding.
That's why a lot of the Baltimore reminiscences here are struck home a lot.
Oh, terrific. Terrific. Where was that?
Where was what?
Television Park.
It was on York Road, just above the Baltimore City line.
Yes.
And below Towson State College.
Yes, I remember it now. It was like near the Amy Jewett Donut Shop down there. Rogers Forge, right?
There was a shopping center across the street, and I believe it had a Stewart's in it.
Yes, Stewart's, which is now gone. Yeah. And that, that's funny, because I originally had a scene in this book, which I cut from, which took place in that Stewart's. The scene didn't work, so I had to go, but I used to shop there. Now it's one of those Caldor places.
Well, we used to go across the street for lunch. And Stewart's had a little cafeteria,
cafe
or something.
Yes, I remember that.
Department stores used to have.
Yes.
And so we used to have lunch there. I moved down to the Johns Hopkins area, and I lived on in a second floor of a brownstone row house,
right
on Calvert Street. And I looked for my old apartment on Calvert Street, and I couldn't find it.
Oh.
And I think that it's a lot of new buildings there, and I think they gutted the entire block.
Yeah, they may have. It's changing. You know, Baltimore's changing rapidly, but it's essentially the same. I mean, the spirit of the city is essentially completely provincial. The neighborhoods are, you know, your neighborhood is great, everybody else stinks. I remember we moved from Govan's to Northwood. You know, you must know these neighborhoods. Govan's was down in York Road in like Winston when I was a little kid. And we moved from Winston Avenue to Northwood across the Lock Raven Boulevard to Winston Road. Same street, but about six blocks over and a couple across the Alameda, across Lock Raven, same street. That was it. The old guys in the old neighborhood wouldn't talk to me anymore. Well, I love it there still. I often think about going back.
How often do you get back?
A lot. My dad died 2 years ago, but my mom still lives there.
In the old neighborhood?
No, she moved out to Westminster. The old neighborhood is, you know, we moved from Northwood to Towson, and finally she then got remarried. My parents got divorced, and then she ended up going off to live in Florida for a couple years, which she hated. And when they moved back, she decided Baltimore was too scary now, so they moved to Westminster, and she hates it. It's boring. She and her friends who are still alive, of course, have to drive too far to see her, and but she feels a little safer there, I guess.
Yeah, crime is a major issue. In fact, it really plays a role more in Red Baker.
Yes.
You see so much, you mentioned the old neighborhood and so forth. In Red Baker, you really focus on the neighborhoods in that.
Where
people, Red Baker, for example, seems to know everybody. No matter where he goes in Baltimore, because he went to school with them.
That's right, yeah. Well, that's how it is. I mean, at least it used to be that way. And I think for that group of people, who stayed in the old neighborhoods down in Highland Town. It still is that way. They go into bars. They see the same guys they've been seeing in bars for 20 years. I went back about 2 years ago. I go into a bar down in Waverly. My grandmother lived in Waverly, 33rd and Greenmount, in that area. And I went to an old bar down there, I know. I immediately see a guy who sat at the bar like 20 years ago. It's like 20 years has not passed, like Rip Van Winkle, you know. So he looks at me, and I go, "Terry, how are you? God, it's good." Now I'm excited, you know. I want to see this guy. He goes, "Hey, Ward." It's like, you know, he said, I said, "What have you been doing? It's been 20 years, he said. "Oh, I'm working in, you know, as a, he had a job as a con, he was doing construction, and after that he had a job as a cab driver, and now he was unemployed. So what have you been doing?" So I told him, you know, that I, what I've been up to, and he said, "Oh, well, you've become a big shot." And he said, "Well, you always were a big shot." We lived on the same block away, you know, from each other. And I lived on Winston, and his father lived on Chateau, which is where the kids live in the King of Cards. And I said, "How can you say I was a big shot? We had the same exact identical red brick row houses. We lived one block away from each other. My father was a Navy guy. Your father was a Navy guy. What are you talking about?" He said, "No, my father was in construction. See, you had it wrong." And he said, "Plus, he helped build your house. And the reason you're a big shot is your houses all had glass chandeliers and ours didn't." That's true. We had these really cheap, you know, cut glass chandeliers that people had back in the 40s. And to him, that was like evidence that I was a swell and that I wasn't really part of the neighborhood. So, you know, and then he laughed about it and said, "Ah, hell, I'm only kidding." But he was only half kidding.
Well, you said Baltimore is provincial, but I guess they say that about New York City, too, because it is also a city of neighborhoods in Boston.
When I left Baltimore, I went off to teach in Ohio, and I taught in...
Where?
I taught at Miami University in Ohio for a couple of years. And Baltimore began to look like Byzantium compared to that. I mean, that was... Ohio was grim.
I tell you, I love Baltimore.
Oh, I do, too. I love it. You know, I wouldn't be writing about it if I didn't love it. But
no, what you seem to be doing is writing about Baltimore in the way that William Kennedy writes about Albany, that you're made at your turf.
Well, I think... it's what I know best, and Baltimore had such a huge influence and stamp on me that, you know, I can't say that I love it. For example, I have friends that moved there from other places, and they think it's the most charming place on earth, and they love it. But they didn't grow up there. You know, when you grow up in a place, you know it in a way they don't know it, and you know the bad things about it, too. They know it as adults. I know it as a kid, and it was that's a different world. I remember wonderful things about it as a kid. But I also remember the stifling qualities it had and the feeling that you were going to go nuts in a place where you were not allowed to sort of do anything except go work at the plant and marry the girl down the street. And if you did anything different, they were going, "What's wrong with you anyway, you know? What do you mean be a writer?" And I was not encouraged to be a writer in Baltimore by anybody. It was like, you know, "You kidding? That's goofy, you know?" And they had a kind of, it's that working class attitude, which is at once super... loyal, great friends. I'm still friends with the same guys that I grew up with, you know. We're still friends all these years later, the ones that are still alive. And on the other hand, there's a kind of keep everybody at the same level herd mentality, you know. That's really tough to take. So I felt like while I love the place and I still love it, I had to get away from it. And I've always been haunted by it. It seems to me like a place that's at once... exciting and the most important place that in my life, but it was also a very stifling and tough place to grow up. It reminded me of when I think about literary, I think of Kennedy, and when I think of other books in the same vein, I think of Kennedy, but I also think of books like, not that we have that much in common, but just that same stifling sense of reality, like Alan Sillitoe's books, like The Loneliness of a Long Distance Runner or something like mm-hmm. that. That same feeling that he had in living in northern England, you know. I had a girlfriend once years ago, and she'd been all over the world. She was sophisticated. I'd been, like, nowhere. I'd been to Washington once. And she said, "Baltimore's Liverpool," you know. And she understood. I mean, I understood immediately what she meant, you know. It's obviously more sophisticated than Liverpool, but it's at the same time, the neighborhoods and that sense of you know, even the way they talk down there, you know, like that. Like we're going down the ocean, hon. Down the ocean every year. It almost sounds cockney.
They say, you know, they say coke, want a coke?
Want a coke?
Yeah.
Right. Gendarmes. They made so much noise, we had to call the gendarmes.
I'll whale you with a rock. Well, Baltimore has a great writing tradition. When the year I moved to Baltimore, Ogden Nash decided to retire there. I remember
that.
Big picture spread in the Baltimore Sun. It's in his backyard of his garden apartment.
Yeah, he came back there basically, I think, to die, didn't he? He didn't live much longer there.
No, he was pretty old, but yeah. It was certainly a more relaxing place than wherever he was before.
But you know what I remember about that? I've always remembered that because I remember an interview with him. Probably we read the same interview in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, they said, how come you came back here, you know? And he said, because I felt like if I couldn't make my peace with this place, I would never know any peace. And I thought, I remember that because I thought, God, that's how I feel. You know, it's a place that somebody asked Faulkner once. I heard the story once that somebody asked Faulkner that about his books. And I said, you know, it must be so wonderful to love a place like Mississippi so much that you want to write about it. And he said, yeah, I love it like a man loves his wife.
Hmm.
And I thought, boy, that's a double-edged. You know, because you know so much about each other, and being married is sort of an embattled position to be in, as well as a great. And that's how I feel about much of Baltimore. It's not just a place that I have fond memories of, although I have obviously tons of fond memories, but it's also a very, very tough place with a lot of very ingrown and tough attitudes.
But you know, that may be true. It may be a tough place, but at the same time, there's a certain gentility. When I was down in Baltimore 2 summers ago, the buses and the benches where you wait for buses all had signs saying, Baltimore, the city that reads.
I know. Isn't that great? No, it is. And there is a wonderful gentility there. You know, my friend Taylor Branch lives there now, and he lives in Mount Washington. And my friend John Yardley lives there, and he lives in Roland Park. And, you know, they have these terrific Victorian homes.
And there's also
Tyler.
Ann Tyler. There's John Barth.
John Barth is teaching at Hopkins.
And all the other, there are so many other people, writers associated with Baltimore. There was Fitzgerald.
Poe.
Obviously Poe. Dashiell Hammett.
Right. Yeah.
Not to mention Mencken. And matter of fact, I think at one point I made a list, and it was a huge list of authors who'd either lived there or born there.
Well, it has a hugely strong stamp. Once you're in Baltimore, it's like no other place. It's not like, I mean, even though it's close to New York, it really isn't much like New York at all, you know. It's really not Southern either, although there are obviously Southern influences. But it's really kind of a unique place, and people have their own sort of unique way of looking at things. And In a world that's become more and more homogenized, I've become more appreciative of it as I get older because it really is like no other place. And even though they're attempting to homogenize it, it resists it. Even though the outward appearance is that you're getting the strip malls and all the other stuff every other place is getting. Just the same, there's a kind of integrity to the neighborhoods and that I've found remains intact. You know, I have lots of friends that live down in Highlandtown where Red Baker was written about, and they are the same funky, crusty people they always were, which I really like, you know. You know, don't come in our neighborhood. Get out of here. And they hate people from Washington, D.C. I mean, these people just, oh, they have such a hatred. My grandfather, when I was a kid, said to me, I was talking to him, he was about 80, he was a carpenter, he was a great guy. He said to me, what do you want to do this weekend? And I said, I want to go over to Washington. I want to see, you know, because I'd never been over there much, you know. And I said, I want to go over to Washington. He said, what do you want to go over there for? And I said, well, I want to see the Smithsonian, and I want to, you know, go to Georgetown and see what that's like. And he said, I don't know why you would want to do that. Those people don't even live where they grew up.
Oh, yeah, 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 the provinciality.
Yeah, so. But I love that, too, you know.
But you could never go back, though. Professionally, it would probably be impossible.
I don't know that it would. We think about it all the time. I mean, that's the funny thing about it. I think about it constantly. I mean, daily, almost. I think about that I have friends there now, and I have my old friends, and I have my new friends, and I've, I have several friends at Towson, at Hopkins, and it would be in many ways easier to go back. I've been doing a lot of screen work and stuff out in L.A., so that makes it, you know, I had to be there to do that, so I would have to give that up. But we have to see if I could ever Never do it. I've thought about it. My wife is ambivalent about it, probably because I am so ambivalent about it. You know,
Robert, you, in writing about Baltimore, you have some distance from it now that
That's
might
right.
make it easier for you to look at the city than it might be if you actually lived there.
Well, that's actually true. When I lived there, the King of Cards, for example, the things that happened in this book that were based, much of it's based on things that really happened to me in my 20s. Many of the events described pretty much happened the way they're described. And then there's, of course, large sections of it are fictional. But at the time when I was going through all the stuff that is described in the book, I couldn't figure out how to make use of it. You know, I remember after these events transpired, I mean, 10 minutes after they transpired, I thought, God, this would make the world's greatest and most fun book to write about. But I couldn't do it. I could not write that book, and I couldn't write it for 20 years. And it took all these years to have enough sort of psychic distance to understand and also to have enough art to know how to take anecdotes and turn them into something more than anecdotes, you know. That's the great advantage of age, and having put the book in a framework where the guy goes back to the town he grew up in, it gives it a chance to be both comic but at the same time poignant, because you can have reflective passages. When I wrote the first draft, there was no framework for it. I just had it started where he moves into the house with Rains and all the other characters in the book, and it didn't work because of that. It needed to have a framework around it. I thought, what books have had frameworks there in the past and that can set up something where you can be both reflective and comic and poignant and all the various things you want to be? And the one I thought of was Breakfast at Tiffany's, which has a framework that's similar, although shorter and not as involved in the actual story. But I took a look at that book again. I thought, this is going to do it. This will make this work. You know, and it was Jane Rose, my editor, and I had a long talk about this, and she agreed this was the way to go. So it was, it really, really helped the book to have that. And of course, that would have been impossible without the distance over the years and the psychic distance from the city. So I had to, in order to write about Baltimore, I really did have to leave it. I don't think I would have been able to write it. I mean, you have to know something else too, you know. So it's. However, one could come back now, and, you know, I could go back there now, I think, and have the same distance, because I am a lot older. And the question is, what do you write about next in terms of Baltimore? If I continue to write it, I've got a new book now, which I'm writing about L.A. for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be fun, too, because I'm getting about to have all my absolute venomous feelings put in one book. I don't have as much affection for, who was it? Somebody said about... Celine. Somebody said about Celine, he has a maggoty affection for his characters. I thought, that's sort of how I feel about Baltimore. But although I'm not a hater like he was. But L.A., it's hard to have any affection. You have to really work at it.
Yeah. Let's go back to the King of Cards, because
right.
the main character is not so much the narrator, but Rains.
Right. Right.
And I understand that this is a character based on someone you actually knew.
He was. He was a wonderful, wonderful friend of mine back in that era. And he was older than I was, just as Rains is older than Fallon in the book. And had a... He was more sophisticated, and he had this unbelievable kind of Machiavellian way of hustling people and... Except Machiavellian is the wrong word, because that implies that it was for his own profit. All his schemes, for the most part, were done to make other people feel good and to have fun. And his great scheme of the identity card world, I mean, this is all based on real stuff. He actually invented an ID card that had pictures on it. Up till then, like, if you had an ID card at a school, like your student activity card, there was no picture on it. It was just, you know, it said your name. And he came up with this whole deal where he would put a picture on it. And immediately was able to start selling these cards everywhere. And also, he was the world's greatest salesman. He could sell, ice cubes to Eskimos. He was unbelievable. But the problem was, when it came to delivering these cards, there were like six people living in this totally whacked out hipsters living in this house. And we were supposed to be the guys who went out, took the pictures, and then came back, developed the pictures, then put the cards through this giant thing called the embosser and laminated the cards and then delivered them, chopped them up with this chopping device, and then took them to the, you know, to the University of Maryland or to one of the schools. And, of course, what would happen is we'd all be stoned out of our mind. We'd all go off to do the pictures, and all that would come out would be like an eye or an ear. they look like surrealist, you know, art. And then we would have to go in to tell these guys who had hired us. You know, I really think that you'll, Jeff will know who he is. You know, that's Jeff, definitely. It's his ear, you can tell. Nobody was buying this stuff. So he was able to sell everything, but not deliver any of it. And I started thinking about that as a metaphor for, first and foremost, it was funny, I thought, in and of itself. It was a wild story. But then I started thinking about it as kind of a metaphor for identity. Because these were identity cards, and these were all kids who were trying to find their identity, including my friend, his real name was Jesse. And we were all trying out these various identities. He was trying out an identity as kind of a mogul slash hipster, you know. And, I mean, one day he would say, oh, let's just throw all this stuff away and just become, you know, go to move to Mexico. And so he was very much a part of the whole hipster era, like everybody else was, you know. But at the same time, there was a part of him that really wanted to be a businessman. He'd say, you know, that's crazy. We have to be billionaires. I mean, look at the Beatles. Those guys have everything. They get to be hippies, but they're also millionaires. That's what I want. And then the next day he would say, ah, forget it. I can't do this. So we were all really confused and loony. And but he had this unbelievable energy. And he would set things up. I mean, he would set people up with girlfriends, and they had no idea that he had set these things up. And his hand was in everybody's life. And I must say it was annoying part of the time, but at the same time it was tremendous fun because the guy was such an unbelievable operator that when you were around him you felt like you were alive. He made you feel like anything was possible and often was. And we had a tremendous amount of fun during that time. So I always wanted to write about it and try to recapture that sense of innocence and possibility and also the goofy confusion of it all.
But I would have assume that the violence that occurs in the book, especially with the mobster toward the end of the book, obviously did not happen. Did
no,
it?
no, it didn't. But what did happen was, in reality, we ended up. I don't want to give away too much of what happens in the book, but what did happen was that because this became undoable in the amateur way we were doing it. That eventually he had to become like a real businessman or not. You know, he couldn't just sit there and make one deal after another and have them all go down the tubes. I mean, people were getting very angry. At first it was charming, and then it turned out to be not so charming. And he did get involved with people who could bankroll the thing after numerous goof-offs and failures, who were horrible people, and who I didn't want to be around, and nobody else wanted to be around. And so I've taken some license in drawing them, but not all that much. These were not great people.
Now you have another subsidiary here. He's the college professor. Tell me about him.
Well, the story of Tom Fallon who's the protagonist of the book, is that his parents are working class people and fairly loony. His father's an obsessive compulsive who washes 7 hours a day in the bathroom, and he goes off to college. Where he meets Dr. Sylvester Spaulding, who is kind of a real literary gentleman. And Tom aspires to gentlemanliness because it seems to be a state of grace that he can't obtain in his home life, of course. And he aspires to a kind of aristocratic literary gentleman, the life of that kind of life. And so he begins to study Henry James and begins to affect Henry Jamesian dialogue, Henry Jamesian's worldview, and also Dr. Sylvester Spaulding's worldview, which is greatly influenced by James. And it occurs to him, though, as a working-class guy from Baltimore, this is absurd. You know, that he's, in fact, although it's interesting, it's completely ridiculous. He's not going to end up in a world anything like the world James described. And yet, at the same time, he longs for it. It's almost like a romance I think James had a lifelong romance with England and with Europe. And Tom has a lifelong romance with James. So, or a temporary romance with him. So Spalding is telling him that basically for him to be an artist, he must live this life that's completely almost like a saint. He must get a room, a well-furnished place, and simply work night and day, read and write and do nothing else. And that he might possibly achieve something with his life. And so he moves into this house with these people, hoping that he will have this room. But it turns out, of course, that the house is run by Rains. So instead of having a well-lit place where he's cut off from the world, he ends up in this, just the opposite. He ends up on the street doing one business hustle after another with Rains and becoming totally involved with Val Jackson, who was a beautiful beatnik poet of the time. And the very kind of person Dr. Spalding told him to stay away from. He considers beatniks the lowest form of life, and their work's not literature at all, and just hopeless junk. And so Tom is torn between this new ideal of gentlemanliness and the world of being a total hustler with Rains and his friends. And I think that makes for some of the comedy in the book, because he wants both these things at once. And why not? I mean, after all, that's sort of the promise of America. You're supposed to be able to have everything, aren't you?
Were your earlier novels set in Baltimore as well?
Shedding Skin, the first half of it is set in Baltimore, and then the second half ends up in California.
And Catalan.
Catalan Little Britches is set in Arkansas, where I went to school. And
I thought you went to Towson State.
I did, but then I went to University of Arkansas to grad school, the creative writing program down there.
I see.
And
Barry Hanna, he studied there too.
He was in my class.
Is that right?
Yeah, we're old friends. It's funny because I was just telling somebody yesterday that of all the people that were in our class, I guess we had 15 guys who were in our, and women too, who were in our class, were going to be prose writers. It was broken up into poetry and prose, just like Iowa. We're the only ones left writing, Barry and I. The other ones have pretty much given up out of our class. There are other ones after us that have done pretty well. Well, they've actually had a tremendous success with our program. I mean, they've published over 125 novels and books of poetry that's come out of there.
Hannah is unique.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a unique writing style that nobody is quite like him.
Oh, no.
I just interviewed him a few weeks ago, in fact.
Barry is a wonderful writer. And
did you read his collection called Bat Out of Hell?
That's a new one, right?
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to yet. But
a lot of interesting things.
No, I want to read it. I've read everything else. I loved Ray. That was a wonderful book.
Now, you also have worked in television as a writer and producer at Hill Street Blues, I think.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, Red Baker came out and got all these terrific reviews, and they all added up to maybe I could go to the Giant once and buy one carton of food.
Now, where were you when Red Baker came out?
D.C.
You were living in Washington.
I lived here for a long time in New York and in the Village. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot of Red Baker in the Village. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, what happened is I wrote another book, about 400 pages of which it never gelled. It was called Baltimore, and it had nothing to do with steelworkers or anything else. It was about a guy going back to Baltimore and trying to find his roots again. And that book just had too many things going on in it. King of Cards, I think, became that book eventually. While I was writing that book, I would go down to Baltimore and hang out and go down to Highland Town and hang out with, not with anything in mind about writing about steelworkers, but I kept talking to them, and I was thinking about they would be interesting background for this other book. And this is actually a true story. It sounds like an apocryphal tale, but it's not. I was so depressed. The book didn't work. It was like 400 pages of like great scenes that never gelled. And I went out one night with Bob Asahina, a friend of mine at Simon & Schuster now, the vice president of Simon & Schuster. He was then an editor at Harper's, and we were drinking downtown at the Odeon somewhere. And I came back to my apartment in the Village, and I thought, I'm so depressed, I felt like suicidal. This giant pile of pages, it wasn't working. And then I sort of heard the first sentence of Red Baker in my head, almost like a vision. And I ran to the typewriter and started writing, and I wrote about 19 pages, pretty much as it ended up being. And I called Asahina about 5 a.m., and he said, "What do you want?" And I said, listen to this. Is this not better than the whole 500-page tome, which I'd forced him to read? And he said, "Oh, God, you're not going to read me pages at 5 a.m., but, true friends will listen." So I did, and he said, "God, that is a lot better." I said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw this whole other thing in the trash and start over." And he said, "Don't throw it in the trash. Put it in the closet." So I put it in the closet literally that second, and 8 months later, Red Baker was written. And my feeling was that Red Baker was writing itself in my subconscious while this other massive thing was, mm-hmm. I had to chip that away to discover Red Baker. So I, at the end of that, I moved to Washington and got married to Celeste Wesson, who was a reporter on All Things Consider. And we were living
in Washington. That's why you moved to Washington.
That's why I moved there, because she was living there.
But all this period, you were freelancing.
Yeah, I lived up here and freelanced for 8 years. Mm-hmm. That's how I made my living. I also sold Catalani the movies and wrote the script for that, which helped mm-hmm. me for 5 years live off that money. But I wrote for everybody. I wrote for Rolling Stone. I wrote for, you know, Esquire, Penthouse, you name it. I've written for them, practically nonfiction. And so now Red Baker comes out, gets all these terrific reviews, but it's not making any money. So I came to my agent up here, Esther Newberg, and I said, she said, what do you want to do next? And I said, I can't write another book right now. I'm too tired. I just don't have one in my head. And she said, would you like, I said, I'd like to go to Hollywood. She said, would you like to work in television? I said, I don't even watch television. I mean, what would I write? She said, well, how about Hill Street Blues? And that was the one show I watched. It's probably the one show most of my friends watched. And I said, yeah, I guess I'd like to work on Hill Street Blues. I mean, I know nothing about it. What's the chances of that happening? It seemed like asking me if how'd you like to play center field for the Yankees or something. It was an equally remote possibility. And she said, well, I don't know. We'll see. They're looking for somebody that's good, and they don't want to get the same old TV guys. So literally the next day, I mean, this was like, I couldn't believe it. I went back to Washington, and I told my wife. We were laughing about it. I said, she's telling me I can work on Hill Street Blues. What a joke, huh? So the next day, about 12 o'clock, these guys call me from Hill Street, and they said, we love Red Baker. We read it, and we want you to try out for the show, and you can write one script for us. And if we like it enough, we'll hire you to be on the staff. I said, what does that mean? They said, well, you would come out and live in Hollywood, and you would be a writer on the show. You'd be actually start out as a position of story editor, but it doesn't mean you edit. It means you'll be a writer. It's like, it's just an old title I left over from the days when there actually were story editors in television. And I wrote it, and again, I wrote it in about 3 weeks. And I flew out there and told them stories, and they loved the stories. I had good cop stories. And the Baltimore Police Department helped me with these stories, and they were terrifically nice guys down there. And I went out, told them the stories, and they loved the stories. And then I came back and wrote the script. And again, I was used to publishing time. You know, I thought I'll hear back from them in, what, a year or something, you know, 6 months. Next day, 24 hours later, we love this script. You're hired. Can you be out here on Friday? It was like Tuesday. I said, do you mean for good? And they said, yeah, well, we'll give you a 13-week deal. If we like you and you like us, you can stay on for the rest of the year, which would be like 10 more weeks. So I said, I'll have to think about it. And then I tapped the phone down and said, I thought about it. And we were, like, the next Friday, I was gone, you know. Celeste was nice enough to pack the family up and move out there. So that worked. It was hard beyond belief, though. I thought it would be, having written this first script, I thought, this won't be that hard to do. But, boy, it was hard.
I imagine it would be.
It was hard. You worked.
There's so many interrelated stories.
That's right.
So you would write a story which would interrelate with a story someone else would write.
Yeah, well, we did it all different ways. You can probably, every way you can think of. Sometimes you would take different stories. You would take a story, I would take a story, we would interweave the two afterwards. You would just do Belker, and I would just do Ferrillo. And then afterwards, we'd sort of figure out how to interweave them in the squad room and stuff like that. That's one way we did it. The other way was you would take the first two acts, there's four acts to a TV show. You would take the first two acts, I would take the second two. Or another way to do it would be you would write the first draft, and I would go through it and write another draft, and then you and I would both look at each other and talked about it and then hand it in. So we tried every single possibility, all with varying degrees of success. And you worked long, long hours. It was a loony place. You worked every weekend. I remember at one point we worked 17 straight weekends without a day off.
Wow. Doesn't Barry Levinson have a show? I think it's called Homicide.
Yeah, he's got
set
one
in Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah.
He's another guy who's mined his roots, hasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly has. He's done some great work about Baltimore. I loved Diner and Tin Man both. I thought they were both terrific.
Did you see Avalon?
Yeah, I liked it. Not as much as the other two. I liked it, though. I thought it was good. I just thought the other two were so good, though. It's hard to live up to those two.
Well, I hope that you continue to mine Baltimore as a source for your work, because you've done a beautiful job.
I had a very good friend, and we're still good friends, actually. And his dad was worked at the steel mill. And I remember the first time I went down there with him, we crossed the bridge over into the Bethlehem Steel. And the first thing I remember was suddenly in front of us, literally a carpet of red dust. Yeah. And I said, "What the hell is that?" And he said, that's the dust from the mill. And I said, "That's what your dad and you breathe all your life?" And he said, "Yeah." And of course, his dad had horrible lung problems all his life. And then we went to these little red brick houses where the guys lived. And it was really something from the 19th century. I mean, I was astonished. It was like 1962. And I remember there was this bike out front, this kid's tricycle, and it had red handlebar grips, rubber handlebar grips. And they were kind of eaten away. And he said those rubber grips have been eaten away by the air.
Yeah.
And I said, "My God, think of what it's doing to your lung tissue, you know." So this was a tough
place. They finally closed those company houses, you know, people had to move out.
Yeah, and I have a lot of friends and relatives both who have lost jobs down there, and it's very, very tough for them. You know, I mean, that's, as Red Baker says in the book, they tell you to go out and become a computer operator at age 40. You know, like when you've done this other thing all your life, and your father probably did it, and his father before him. So it's, these guys have not only a tough road to hoe in terms of money, where they've lost their jobs and their money and security, they also have to do the psychological twist where they suddenly have to become new guys at age 40. And it's, you know, it's not easy for anybody.
Well, Kim Card's wonderful book
Thank
about
you.
The Baltimore by Robert Ward. Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you so much.